Good morning. And for those of you celebrating Passover, like me, Chag Sameach. My name is Raina Wells, and on behalf of Ontario Media Development Corporation, I'm pleased to welcome you to the third in our series of four digital dialogue breakfasts. I'd especially like to thank PwC for its support of this series, and also to thank our panelists this morning for taking the time to participate. I'm sure that many of you know that OMDC is an agency whose mandate is to build Ontario's creative economy through a range of innovative programs and funding for the book and magazine publishing, film and television, music, and interactive digital media industries. After the panel, we should have a bit of time for another cup of coffee and some more networking, so please do stay if you can. Our moderator this morning is Lisa Coleman. Lisa is a partner in PwC's Audit and Assurance Group and part of the firm's Technology, Communications, Entertainment, and Media Practice. Please join me in welcoming Lisa Coleman.
Thank you and good morning, everyone. What I'll do is I'll first introduce our panelists, and then we have each one of them has brought a quick overview of their companies. And then we'll have a dialogue up here, and then we'll take questions from the floor. So if we start at the far end, the first person is Lisa from Kids Can Press. And if you have a librarian or a teacher in your house, you would know who Lisa is, as I do in my household. Kids Can Press is a subsidiary of Chorus and has the most Canadian kids publishers within their portfolio, such names as Franklin, Scaredy Squirrel, who I love, and others. It's quite an impressive list of books that they have authored in the past. Then we move over to Yav from Uberflip, and I'll let him introduce his company in a second. But Yav is the founder and CEO of Uberflip and has worked with a number of young companies as they come up with ways to continue to evolve and utilize the change in consumer behaviors as we move into the digital arena. So it'll be great to hear from him. And then I have Mike to my immediate left. He is the CEO of Maven Say, and I'm sure he's got some interesting stories as he's worked with Malcolm Gladwell in the past, I hear. He lives now in New York, but has lived here in Toronto, was raised in Toronto, and is a lawyer. Sorry, I had to make a lawyer crack. The other interesting thing about Mike is that he was a participant in the Road Trip Nations, where he was picked to go across North America and interview a number of entrepreneurs on how they were able to take their companies and be successful. So maybe you'll have some interesting stories about that. So if we move on to the presentation, I thought what I'd do is just start with some interesting information that I was able to collect. The benefit of the internet is you can find lots of good tidbits. But if you look at where we are today from digital, some interesting information that I wanted to put forward to introduce and set the stage for our discussion today. The three themes come from the PwC E&M Outlook that we publish every year. So this was from our 2012 Entertainment and Media Outlook. But what we said is that consumers now are mobile. Nothing as a surprise from that perspective. But what is interesting is that Canadians, over 70% of Canadians, now have a mobile device. That 3 years ago was below 40%. So the increase in penetration is astronomical over the last 3 years from a mobile perspective. And then the spending is equally impressive from a growth perspective. Obviously, consumers are demanding content anywhere, any place, and across multiple platforms. I tried to bring my playbook today and got frustrated because I couldn't take stuff from my BlackBerry to my playbook. But just an interesting rant for the morning. And then what's also interesting is in North America, consumers are not cutting, as they call, cutting the cord. TV is still the preferred platform to receive content, TV or internet. So cable and or your internet providers are still the preferred platform. So an interesting perspective that you'll see, the Canadian Media Fund is doing a series of papers on the second screen and how to utilize the second screen in order to engage and pull people back to the main platform being the TV or the internet. So that's an interesting place to go if you want some information on the second screen. It's on the Canadian Media Fund website. Then from a social perspective, again, an interesting bit of information about Canada. We are in the top 10, so around the world, we're in the top 10 countries that are most engaged from a social media perspective. Our little wee country meets the definition and is in the top 10. So that's also an interesting statistic for Canada. 80% of Canadians are on Facebook. And if you look at the Canadian Media Fund study, they talk about how many Canadians will post to their Facebook or to their Twitter account information about a TV show as they're watching the TV show. Again, the amount of engagement is really high as people use the second platform while watching TV. And then we are social. Again, from an engagement perspective, as we continue down that area, we want to share content. An interesting thing is that we are really moving towards a sharing of content versus owning. And so how do we continue to leverage sharing versus owning content? But we are still willing to pay for quality in the experience. And then the second screen is what I keep referring to, the multitaskers. The definition I heard actually at the digital dialogue in January, which I loved, is that we're developing a generation. Our kids are all a generation where they leak focus or they lack focus, which I've got two kids in my house and I totally understand that. They cannot stay focused on a game or content for more than 5 minutes before they have to go and do something else on another platform. So these are just the two bullets there is information directly out of the Canadian Media Fund papers that they've released. And then local is, again, another area of high focus these days. How do you make something, an experience, very specific to an individual in order to engage them and keep them focused so that they don't leak the focus? How do you keep them focused on the content that they're currently looking at and engaged? So that's just an opening to the dialogue today of what we're seeing from a consumer behavior perspective. And so then how does that tie back to what companies are doing in order to continue to have consumers watch and use content as it's distributed throughout the network? So I'm first going to go to, these guys are in particular order. Mike has a video that he's put together on his company and what Maven Say does.
I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, damn, that's one well-dressed bear. His name is Fred, and everything he's wearing has been recommended on a new iPhone app called Maven Say. And that song you're listening to, and that magazine he's got there. Yep, found them both on Maven Say. In case you're wondering, it's a bourbon. You can guess where he discovered it. And as for the lady friend, well, that was all Fred. Now I know what you're thinking, and I agree. You gotta get that app.
The next video is Uberflip and what that company does.
Yeah. we started this business in 2008, it was all about helping companies communicate their content more effectively on the web. As that vision has grown, so has our team. We've really brought on passionate, energetic, and talented people to help us execute.
What we're building here requires a team effort. Everyone has to buy in. Whether you're a developer or part of the sales, marketing, or support team, we all have to believe in delivering an amazing customer experience. So when we hire someone, they need two key things. They need to be amazing at what they do, and they have to gel with our culture.
I lead the marketing team here, and we're working on some great, impactful projects that focus on our technology. This really makes coming into work a rewarding experience.
So right now I'm on a chat with a client, and I'm helping them with some ideas on how they can better leverage our platform.
I just got off the phone with a new client who we helped get up and running.
Right now I'm coming up with the research and content for next month's edition of Going Digital.
We spend a lot of time here, so we want this to be an amazing place to come and work. We have foosball, beer fridge, ping pong, yoga every couple of weeks, and you can wear whatever you're most comfortable in, so we get the real you.
We're building bleeding edge technology here, especially in the mobile space. And that's why we bring on developers who are really experienced gurus in their field. They come to Uberflip to build game-changing products.
I'm currently working on the analytics infrastructure using some pretty cool technology like MongoDB.
I'm working on the customized video player for the mobile app using Sensha Touch, HTML5, and CSS3.
So I'm working on the next version of our library app utilizing technologies such as PhoneGap, Backbone.
One of the many things I'm currently working on is modernizing our Linux-based infrastructure.
I can't really tell you what I'm working on right now, but let's just say it's going to blow your mind.
All team members work side by side, regardless of title. Forget about open doors. There are no doors in our office.
I'm Rob, lead Java developer.
I'm Gregory, senior developer.
I'm Aaliyah, marketing coordinator.
I'm Peter, customer support.
I'm Neil, director of marketing.
I'm Randy, Chief Operating Officer.
Hi, I'm Yoav. I'm the CEO. And here at Uberflip, we're building an incredible platform with an amazing team for the coolest customers.
Okay. And then Lisa has some slides.
Yeah, I'll just use the first couple, thanks. So Kids Can Press is Canada's largest independent children's book publisher. And you may recognize us from some of the characters that Lisa mentioned earlier. About 50% of our business is in the U.S. market, and the other 50% in Canada. In the U.S., about 70% of our business is to the school and library market. It's about 50-50 trade school library market in Canada. We also sub-publish in many languages around the world with local partners. And as the next slide shows, we're part of the Chorus family, which is a really unique place to be for a publisher, particularly in the Canadian market, because it allows us to align and leverage the many media assets that you see here that the company has. And a recent one that's very exciting for us is the recent acquisition of the right to represent iVillage in Canada, which of course is very women and mom centric. So you will see lots more coming from Kids Can Press and iVillage around reading for kids and digital moms. And that's just an example of some of the things that we're doing right now with iVillage. And this just gives you a sense of our approach. Really, we're about fabulous brands that we take to as many platforms as we possibly can. And it's a sample of what Franklin, 25 years later, is up to. And Lisa talked about Scaredy Squirrel. If you don't know Scaredy Squirrel, you need to know him. He's the Woody Allen of squirrels. He's neurotic about everything. And we've sold about 1.5 million copies of his books all around the world. And this is our big opportunity and our big challenge, which I guess we'll touch on this morning. Just go back to the other one. And this, of course, is one of our main areas of focus right now is ebooks and apps. And cool things that other people are doing with kids' books and apps, because I believe that promotional opportunities, we do a lot around brand building with other brands and aligning with them. And so they're all asking these days if there is a digital component to their brand promotion, and some people are already taking advantage of that.
Okay, so that's a little bit of an introduction to the companies. I thought it was important because Lisa is a traditional media company, but the other two companies are utilizing technology in order to help media companies. So wanted you to understand how they fit into the dialogue before we start the conversation. So I'm going to start with the first question, which is, knowing what consumers are demanding, what have each of you done from a company perspective in order to capitalize and optimize digital and the consumer demands from a content perspective? I'll start with you, Mike.
Sure. So we are a consumer-facing social mobile application. So basically, we're still a relatively early stage company. We launched our app about 4 or 5 months ago in the App Store. So everything we do is for the consumer at this point. And our consumers, our target audience is sort of 18 to 34 males and females. Our audience is actually predominantly female, 65% female, which is a really good mix from a advertising perspective. But it's a very demanding consumer market for us. We're essentially trying, it's a recommendations app for, let me just take a step back and explain a little bit more than the fancy ad. It's a community for high quality recommendations. So instead of something like Yelp, which our demographic is really finding to be lacking in a number of areas, primarily it's not social enough and it doesn't have a great mobile experience. So if I'm looking for a great new restaurant or music or anything in the lifestyle realm, I want to know what my friends recommend. I want to know what influencers, mavens, Maven is an expert, a trusted expert. I want to know what they recommend because that's more relevant to me, that's more interesting to me. So we're kind of centered around what some people would call the interest graph, or what we could even call the word of mouth graph, how you learn about interesting, cool new fashion, music, books, TV shows. It's an app for all that. So we're really trying to disrupt some dominant players like Yelp, and our marketing focus so far has been predominantly in New York. Our company's based in Toronto and New York, so I go back and forth a lot. And we've got a pretty good early adopter community in New York, a bunch of big cities, New York, LA, San Francisco, Toronto, London in the UK. And the market is, like I said, extremely demanding. So these are kind of young, savvy, urban culture junkies, essentially, which is why we started the company, because that's who we are as well. And you're competing with everything for their attention, whether it be other social networks like Instagram, which is really, for our audience, by far the most dominant social network right now, or entertainment, live entertainment, like concerts, whatever it is, you're competing for mindshare and engagement across the board. So what we've done in order to break through is, one thing is put a huge focus on building a brand as opposed to just launching a product. And that's something that you could see in the video and in other ways. We've done a couple videos actually, and we do really interesting photo and video collaborations with brands and tastemakers. That's how we've built our early adopter community. So we had the idea that it would be, in order to really build a meaningful, engaged foundation for our consumer community, we wanted people to learn about the app through sources that they trusted and thought were cool, as opposed to traditional PR or Facebook advertising or any of those other slightly more traditional strategies. So I think that would be one big lesson for us, is you really got to build a brand that connects to the audience, as opposed to just launching a product.
Rob, if you could you talk a little bit about your product and your experience with digital? Because I want to come back and ask Mike a question once you've introduced your product. Sure. And your approach.
Sure. So what we do is we help magazine publishers, and really now any enterprise, with multi-page documents, such as PDFs, to convert that stale content into a more engaging experience, a page flipping experience that they can then layer interactive elements on top of, such as videos and photo galleries and tweet buttons. And then ultimately, we offer them analytics so they can see how users are actually engaging at page level. So everything you expect to learn about your website per page level, we offer that same insight per page level of your documents. And of course, we make them mobile friendly, delivered through the browser, so they're easily accessible and crawlable by search engines.
Can you talk a little bit about the fact that your product is outside the App Store?
Yeah, sure. So one of the first things that that we did when, even before the iPad came out, was we were lacking a mobile solution. We had a great desktop browser solution, but we didn't have anything for mobile. And that's, you know, this is back in around 2009, where everybody's pushing for an iPhone app. And it just, it didn't make sense to me to build content that would be locked in an app store when the first thing you want to do is get it in people's hands and everybody goes to search engines to find content. So we took the approach that we would build an app-like experience but delivered through the browser. So it still had a URL. You could still link to it from your email campaigns or your tweets. And we decided to build it once and have it work across any screen. And that was, you know, this is back in early 2010 that we actually launched this product. And we got to tout that we had a solution for the iPad before the iPad launched. So that was a really important key for us. So that was our first version. We're now into our third version of this product. And that approach is, you know, it makes a ton of sense. And we're seeing more and more and more media companies and content publishers moving away from the App Store for, you know, a variety of reasons, one being 30% of Apple's cut. But just accessibility. You know, if it's about content, it's about reaching an audience, the best place to do that still is through the browser.
So I want to come back to Mike. Mike has made a decision to have his app in the App Store. Just would like your perspective on that decision versus Uberflip, which is outside of the App Store.
Yeah, so, I mean, for, you know, we're not a publisher with existing content looking to distribute that efficiently via mobile, where that solution may be a better one. There's not a lot of choice when you're launching a social consumer app. You can choose the platform. You know, there's a lot of thinking today around whether to go iPhone first, iPhone only, Android, etc. And for us, that was a function of our target audience, which is still predominantly iPhone dominated, even though the Android market overall is, I think, bigger now. And that I could draw a parallel to Instagram again. That's kind of their strategy, and they, you know, built an audience of, I think it was 30 million users before they introduced their Android app. But you know, the App Store is in some ways a great place to distribute a product, and in other ways a challenging one. The main benefits is just that it's completely universal and open, and it's really easy for anyone in the world to find our app. You just go to the App Store, you search Maven, say, we made the product available globally, so we've got some interesting niche communities all around the world, including sort of places like China or Brazil. You know, it's just a handful of users or 100 users here and there, but that's really one of the big benefits of the App Store. Some of the drawbacks include it's completely controlled by Apple, obviously. So not just from a sales perspective, but also in terms of product releases. You know, the way it works is, some of you are probably familiar, but every time you want to update your app, you have to submit that to Apple. Apple goes through a review process, which takes about a week, and then that release goes into the App Store, which is, from a development perspective, very different than web development, where you can just deploy fixes into a live environment anytime you want. So that creates a lot of challenges for a consumer product. If there's something wrong with our app, which happens, you know, regularly, it happens to all the giants in our space, it takes time to get that out to the world, which is very stressful, especially if you're doing big, you know, marketing around that stuff. So I'd say, you know, for us, strategically, it was absolutely clear cut that we had to distribute our app to the App Store, but the App Store is kind of its own you know, art that you have to know how to navigate.
So Lisa, now we'd be really interested in hearing from you. You gave us a little bit of a teaser on how you're taking the traditional media and moving into the new opportunities, how you're doing that, and perhaps you can start to introduce some of the challenges of doing that too.
Sure. Maybe I'll touch on the operational side of things, not as sexy, but really important. So we started with a reorg, actually, within Kids Can Press about a year and a half ago because we identified some gaps and competencies to get us into the digital world in a meaningful way. So we brought in more talent that would enable us to create our own products and not be reliant on the outside, as well as people with a lot of social media skills, because a lot of this is word of mouth and telling people about your products in a digital way as well. So that was phase one. And in the meantime, there was a decision on Chorus's part to reinvest significantly in Franklin the brand, which has done incredibly well over the years. And on the book side alone, 61 million copies sold worldwide. So our sister company, Nelvana, created new CGI animated television episodes. And from there, it just ballooned into all we could possibly do as a result of that. So we have spin-out books that are on your chairs that are part of the television series. There are apps that are built on the television series that are on the other side of the book that are promoted there. We are relaunching 41 book products into the U.S. market this year, and social media will be a big part of how we do that. We have two audiences, really. We're not really speaking to children, obviously, through social media. We're speaking to digital moms as well as educators who are online a lot and like to talk to each other and recommend products to each other. And as for the challenges, I mean, I think one of the biggest one that probably everybody in this room is facing is attention for screen time. You know, in the adult side of publishing, a lot of business is being lost to e-books because it's very easy to translate a print version into a digital copy. Creating children's illustrated color e-books is a much more challenging thing to do. It's not as straightforward. So as yet, the experience is that we're not losing any market share at all to e-books, but rather our competition is for screen time as part of a child's reading time, whether it's a physical or digital book.
So I'd be interested in one of the as you go across multiple screens and as you are trying to keep people focused on your screen versus the other screen they may have in their hand or have that always have that demand on their time. I'd be interested as we go across the panel on what you're doing in order to continue to engage with your communities or consumers. And I'll start with Mike because from a product perspective, their entire philosophy is that you've got to engage your consumers in order to keep them focused on your content or your brand. So I'd be interested in your perspective on the whole concept of engagement and how you are being successful in keeping people focused on a particular item or brand.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that is probably the number one challenge for a product and company like ours is engagement. It's really difficult, and it is what defines a consumer-facing product. There's really scary statistics about the drop-off rate for apps. I think it was recently said that 70% generally of people who download an app never use it again. So how to engage, retention and engagement are really the core challenges. That's what separates an absolute viral phenomenon like Instagram, which is in my mind really challenging incumbents like Twitter, which have responded with, I don't know how familiar the audience is with the landscape, but Twitter has launched an app called Vine, which is a video, micro video app. I mean, it's a very fast moving space where basically product designers and developers are trying to figure out products that engage people more than what's currently out there. And so it's the product itself ultimately that has to be the key driver of engagement. So we do marketing and brand development that I can talk about that helps engagement, and that certainly helps with user acquisition. But at the end of the day, it's the product. So that would be the user experience. What does the product do? Is it generally, you know, a lot of the time it splits into something that's either incredibly useful, like Uber, for example, which I'm sure some of you use for getting taxis, or Songza, which is a very popular app for music curation. Those are just those are utilities, I would call them. They're just incredibly useful, so they engage you. On the other hand, it could be something that's incredibly fun, and that's what something like Instagram or Vine does, and they create a network effect eventually that just keeps you sucked in. So it's a really interesting exercise, and as an early stage product, we're actually still, you know, doing a lot of testing and development and data analysis about what we think will really crack the engagement challenge for us. And that's why, you know, they say product designers are CEOs of a lot of consumer startups, because the user experience is so critical. We have an amazing designer is one of the most important pieces to our team. But it's kind of like, I guess, the million-dollar question or problem. If you can create a product that is truly engaging in the marketplace, then you're winning in the consumer space.
Yav, if you could answer the question about engagement, and particularly as you've gone out and discussed your product and how your consumers are using your product, because again, your product is very focused on enhancing the engagement with content. And so what are your consumers saying to you are the advantages or disadvantages as they struggle with engagement, and how they're using your product to enhance around that challenge?
Right. So, you know, first off, we're a B2B product. So our customers pay us for our solution, but we're actually B2B2C. So we're actually tasked with providing a great tool set for our customers' consumers. So, you know, we're constantly under the gun to make sure that we're providing a platform for engagement. We serve about 40 million pages a month. So there's a lot of obvious engagement there. And statistically, our type of solution of flipping through pages rather than static websites has proven to be a lot more engaging. People spend about 5 minutes on average once they discover a document in our solution. And they obviously have the ability to share it. So there's definitely a lot of pressure on us to make sure that our solution is both easy to find and also very engaging. That's why we offer elements such as, you know, adding interactive elements anywhere on a page and really bringing that document to life. But you know, the challenge comes in, you know, how do you create that for us? Is how do you create that native experience? And we all love native apps because they're so fluid and they're so fast and they feel great. How do you create that experience in a browser? And that's really, you know, that didn't work so well a couple of years ago because, you know, browsers really, this is a little technical, but browsers just aren't as fast at rendering content as that native app is, because it's native to the device and it gets to use the true guts of the hardware. But that's changing. And what we're seeing is, especially on newer devices like iPhone 5, we're able to produce a very native-like experience in the browser. And that's, you know, when we talk about engagement, you know, we keep talking about iPhones, but there's also Android out there, and now there's Windows Phone and BlackBerry's making a comeback. And that's another part of the advantage of going with a mobile web strategy, is that our technology works across any device. So you publish once with our tech and you get maximum exposure. So you're saving a lot of money, first of all, because, you know, our solution starts at $30 a month versus having to build a native app that could cost you 10 grand or up. So we're offering a very quick and easy way to get into the playing field of engaging an audience with your content. And we're also offering it a way to get it across any device, which is, you know, just not possible. And it makes perfect sense for Mavensaid to build what they've done. I mean, I see companies building web apps for platforms, which is really what I'd say Mavensay is. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't really make sense. At the end of the day, native apps are going to win in the arena where they are providing a platform to access a variety of content, or a game, or even an interactive games is a good example, or even your banking software. You're going to want that as a native app. But once you go outside that realm, and even things like perhaps a color book, and I see you're not getting a lot of pressure from ebooks, but we have a lot of customers that are bringing colorful books and much more rich media to our technology because it's so easy to produce an engaging interactive experience on the web.
So we'll talk later, and I want to hear about the bear, if there's a book in the bear. Maybe not for our audience.
So Lisa, we hear a lot about publishers and the challenges as you take the traditional book, and particularly with kids, they want to be engaged. And so be interested in how you're doing in taking your traditional media and move it into the realm of gaming or engagement as you deal with kids in order to keep them enticed with the content.
So maybe I'll touch on a product example, and then in terms of a marketing example as well, not necessarily aimed at kids. But in terms of product, a lot of our focus has been on ebooks, available in the ebook store as opposed to the app store, a lot more economical to produce. And again, the specs to create these products were only released about 18 months ago in terms of color and the complexity behind that. So one of the things we learned very quickly with the ebooks is that those that we provided audio with, what we call a read-along function, so that would be the bouncing ball, has pretty much become standard, both for the children and for the adults. They like the fact that this is really a reading tool, a literacy tool. And so that's been one of the ways we've been able to engage not only children, but also adults, to say this is something I'm really excited for the kids to get involved with. And on the marketing side, I'll use Scaredy Squirrel as an example because in part it's a community and a fan base that's rabid. And we all know it's feeding the machine, right? So you want people to be talking about it. You want to be engaging with them. So this past Christmas, we launched something called Scaredy Squirrel Prepares for Christmas. It was our first guidebook in a physical book format. And so the marketing team had a very clever initiative where they created gingerbread houses. Now, Scaredy Squirrel is everything is about code and doing it to the rules. So this included duct tape and all the kinds of things that Scaredy Squirrel would use, as well as a real gingerbread kit that you could actually make with your kids. So we sent them to the Uber fans and the influencers and the key teachers and librarians and asked them simply to please go and have some fun over the holidays and make this, but be sure to post it on social media and show everybody what a great gingerbread house that you made. And that was a huge success. Not only did we delight our customers and our fans, but indeed they did share far and wide. And I think one of the most fun was we shared with the Property Brothers, who have a show on W, and they actually added to it and made this monstrosity that was about this big and tweeted and Facebook out to their whole network as well. So that was a huge success.
Everyone has talked about community engagement and great examples of how you use social media in order to engage your audience and to develop a fan base. I'm going to finish with the ultimate question, which is making money. From a perspective of mobile, one of the biggest challenges that we hear all the time is there money to be made or found in the digital space, in the digital arena? Because we have developed a culture in North America of free and accessible information. So I'm going to finish the discussion with the panel on how have you been successful in monetizing as you move into the digital space? And I'd be interested in I would like the panel to give me the most innovative way that they have thought about monetizing digital. And I want it to be positive. I'm making it challenging for the panel.
Okay. The innovative part is a little scary. so our revenue model is primarily ad-based, but It's in terms of, we haven't started implementing our revenue model yet. We're first building up a robust community. We started piloting some of the revenue opportunities with brands that we think are on brand for our community. And it's ad-based, driven by sponsored, targeted content. So we curate content in the app. Right now it's weekly. It's going to be driven a bit more algorithmically going forward, and it's interest driven. So if it'll present you with a great place to go for brunch this weekend on Queen West, or it'll present you with fashion that is relevant to you based on your interests, based on the other content that you've liked and commented on and shared internally within Mavensay. The mobile ad market overall is actually growing tremendously. It's projected to reach, I think by 2016, according to eMarketer, $20 billion. I think that's just in the US. People are struggling to figure out exactly how to do it, how to capitalize on that market. But for us, it's a very natural fit because we've seen it working even on a bartering basis. So what we've done so far with certain brands that we really like is we'll promote them in the app to the entire app community, or it can be targeted based on location and interest. And in exchange, they will, I guess this is the innovative part, in exchange, they will help promote Mavensay, the app, which is still, fairly early stage app and much smaller than the audience of some of these brands. They'll promote the app to their audience. So it's kind of a co-promotional opportunity that has actually been very successful for us in introducing the app to our target market. There are other, for us specifically, the whole app is a word of mouth positive promotion platform. So it's all about experiences and services and products that are being promoted socially and through authentic social relationships. It's definitely going to be a challenge to maintain the authenticity of that community while bringing in sponsored content. But we've seen examples. Twitter actually has done it pretty well. Their model is cost per engagement. So they have sponsored content in the feed or in search results with promoted tweets and stuff like that. And I think one of the reasons why it has generally worked is because there's a creative component to it. So a lot of these brands, some of the biggest brands in the world, like something like Pepsi or Pizza Hut, they'll put out a promoted tweet, but they'll actually do it. The tweet itself, the content itself, is pretty creative. So it's in the interface of Twitter, in that case, it's denoted that it's a promoted piece of content, but consumers have actually responded pretty positively to it because the content itself has been either funny or entertaining or has some kind of deal in it that is attractive to those users. So I think there's actually a pretty fluid way to do it, and that's what we'll be doing probably in the next 3 to 6 months.
Okay. I'll flip down to Lisa.
Sure. Yes, we're making money. I don't think as much as fast as some people had hoped. And that's true generally of the children's market. The uptake hasn't been as quick as folks anticipated. It seems to be leveling off in the adult market at around 20% right now, but we don't see the children's market getting there for another 3 years. And in terms of innovation, I think what I'd like to touch on is based on one of our challenges, which is discoverability. The tree, proverbial tree, ebook falls in the woods, and who knows, it's there now. And so an innovation that we've taken advantage of is something called NetGalley, which is an opportunity to, importantly, in making money is also saving money, an efficient way to get review copies of our books, physical, which also usually have an ebook component to them, to a reviewer. And so it's an online tool where reviewers sign up and say, I'd like to get a digital version of your book to review. They are vetted first by NetGalley to say, yes, you are someone that is actually going to write about books and don't
just want free books. And then they apply to us and they say, yes, we'd like a digital version of your book. And then we say, yes, thank you. And it's been a great tool for us, not only for saving money, but extending our reach to people who we didn't even know were out there that were interested in writing and blogging about our books.
And Yoav, maybe you can answer the question both from your company's perspective, but more importantly, what you're seeing your consumers use your software for in order to optimize the digital content.
Sure. You touch on a good point, discoverability. So again, it's all about us providing tools for our customers to be more successful selling their content. The obvious use case is magazines and digital subscriptions. But even looking at one-off sales such as ebooks or white papers, you see a lot of companies trying to sell their white papers, getting a fill out a form, whether it's free or whether you have to pay, and then you access this end product, which is typically a PDF, and then they have no idea if you even read it. So we solve that. But more importantly, we offer the tools that allow to capture that user information, so an actual subscription system that we empower our customers to set up forms, set up payment integrations with PayPal, for example, to actually receive funds, and then deliver that content in an engaging way. But discoverability is still a big challenge. I mean, even though we're making this SEO friendly and people can discover this content more easily, we're actually working on a tool right now that does an even better job at promoting a brand's full spectrum of content. So it's a tool that's going to allow you to bring in all of your content, whether it's your blog articles or your tweets or your videos on YouTube, and actually create a curated experience, much like compared to Flipboard in terms of what that does for the consumer space. It's basically Flipboard for marketers, so that you can now promote your entire envelope of content to drive your audience to a specific call to action, whether it's download our ebook or buy this product. So we're creating a really blowing up that whole engagement level that right now we as marketers or any company really has content sprinkled all over the web, whether we're spending time on Twitter or YouTube or anywhere else. We don't really own that content anymore. So we're providing a tool set to really bring the ownership back to our customers and create a branded experience that can now do a better job leveraging that existing content that lives out there and driving them towards that action.
Great. So we've heard from the panelists. It would be really good if we could take some questions from the audience now. We have about 10 minutes before we want to end. And so I'll ask you to wait for a mic, because your question we want to have on the video.
Mic's up beside you.
I'm not going over there.
It was just second row, second person in. Thank you.
Hi. Peter Miller with Interactive Ontario. My question, I want to start with Lisa, but maybe go to everyone else. We do a conference in the spring called In Play about kids, and one of the themes we want to explore this year is what kids' digital media tells us about all other digital media. And it's kind of interesting, and you said a few things, Lisa, because in one way, kids are the canary in the coal mine because they adopt it so freely. On the other hand, it's very different. It tends to be mediated. Cell phones, for example, have got down to kids maybe 8 and 10. They're not yet in kids that are 4, although I'm sure that's going to happen. But how do you look at that, the dimensions between what you learn from the kid space and what that teaches for other demographics and vice versa?
What's interesting is our sweet spot actually is in the much younger children's age range. So picture books really is our sweet spot. So we really are talking fairly young children. So I think those, they're going to give us every indication of what's next, really. And I'm fascinated when I am anywhere in public and I see kids with devices, big and small, and eating it up voraciously. So I think what it's reinforcing is that those of us in the content business actually have a really bright future, because children and adults want as much as we can, package up for them in different and interesting ways. And I think the rate at which kids consume media in general and have a huge appetite for it is a really positive thing.
Can I just add to that question, Lisa? I've got an 11-year-old and 6-year-old in the house. Be interested in your perspective as we look at generations. Are we, though, at risk that they are too used to free content. My kids are always finding the free content versus, whereas I'm the one that's saying, no, you have to pay for it. So, you know, I'm a different generation and have grown up in the copyright era and had a librarian in the house that was very fixated on the fact that I wasn't allowed to photocopy. You know, what's your perspective on the free versus I'm from a generation where I knew I had to pay for content?
You bet. It's a big challenge, and particularly in the kids' space, we see, you know, desire for a low price point and a huge high whiz-bang factor, which costs a lot of money to make. But I think at the end of the day, if you create a great product, and a lot of this goes back to branding, you can generate the revenue. If I look at the Treehouse app that our friends at Nelvana have created, that's a subscription that's $9.99 a month, and it's got kind of limitless video content in it, and that's doing incredibly well. It's trusted content that parents feel good about. It's got a great brand name, and they've got a huge platform to market it against. So, you know, when you hit all the right notes, but yeah, it is a challenge.
Yoav or Mike, do you have anything to add to the generation conversation?
Sure. I've an almost two-year-old at home, and she consumes content like crazy. It's actually a little scary. She's really addicted to her iPad, but it's amazing how much she can learn. She's not even two, and she knows the alphabet. You know, I don't think I came anywhere. Probably took me until I was six before I knew the alphabet. Definitely there's engagement there. But you know, on the point of content being free or paid, I think you have to accept that you can't lock down content as a whole. You can have your premium offering, but you have to give free. You have to give it because that's the only way you're going to engage an audience enough to, you know, trust that brand. And you know, Treehouse already has that trust. They didn't do so through their app. They did so through, you know, Rogers or Bell. You have to accept that you have to give away a significant amount of your content in order for people to pay for that premium. And that's just proving itself everywhere.
And if I can just build on that a little bit, I think there's a misconception that digital production is easy and cheap. And certainly, I only know it from our business, is, you know, creating an ebook from, you know, illustrated spreads, it's not like just disassembling a television show that has digital assets. This has to be recreated. You know, these are not digital or separate assets when we create the book originally. It's one big one that then has to be relayed out like this. So, you know, the costs are significant to us, even though the price points aren't.
Any other questions from the audience? Yes.
Analytics to your customers. Could you describe that a little bit? Because that's one of the challenges, communicating how well your product is doing. Are you using a proprietary system or?
Yeah, so we actually just redeveloped this past year our entire analytics platform. So we offer an integration with Google Analytics for those familiar with it to actually get that page level insight that you're used to for a website at page level for your documents. But we did build a proprietary system that gives you really detailed insight into your content. So we have over 25 metrics that we actually collect. So your typical stuff like your unique visitors and your page views, but even specifically where your audience is clicking to zoom in on a page, we'll track that, show you a heat map, what countries they're coming from, the breakdown of tablets versus phones versus desktop. So we actually have over 125 reports at the end of the day to really dive deep into your content. We also offer those interactive widgets, so we can show you which widgets are being interacted with, whether it's videos or slideshows or tweet buttons. And then we show you where your content's being shared to, so what social platforms is your audience actually spending time at, because they're sharing to that audience. So we hit pretty much every note in terms of what you'd want to know about your content. And we do so in real time. So every report is available in real time.
Mike, do you have statistics that you give back to your brands or information you give back on the engagement?
Yeah. So from a business model and brand perspective, it's one of the things that we think that we're uniquely positioned to do is we're tracking influence and word of mouth. So if
somebody comes on the app and recommends a new song. Oh, we're writing a little trend report on this now. So there's a band that's kind of blowing up in the U.S. They were very popular at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas, a couple weeks ago. And the name is Haim. They're still kind of underground, but they're going to be very big with our audience. They were recommended on our app about just when we launched, maybe 5 months ago. And we can see exactly how that content performed and spread amongst influencers. So, you know, it was a downtown New York kind of East Village, you know, hipster recommending the song. And then we track through kind of a word of mouth graph how that spread. So that person recommended it, and then it was shared by someone below them. And then there's kind of a really complicated tree that we track on the back end, showing the different nodes of influence. And then a month ago, a well-known DJ named Samantha Ronson, who has 2 million Twitter followers who uses our app, also recommended it and then posted it to Twitter. And then the band itself responded because they know her and she's you know, significant person to be tweeting that out. And essentially what we have is a record of how a trend started, or is still developing, really. And one of the things that we pride ourselves on is being early in those trends, given our audience and what the app is for. So that's something, those data analytics we're tracking, and ultimately we could package those and sell data reports as well. But it's definitely an area that we're fascinated by, and one of the reasons why we created our platform in the first place.
Okay. So we're nearly at 10 o'clock. We'll finish up just as a summary. Today we did talk a lot about digital. We talked a lot about what the consumer's demanding, and wanted to bring to the table three different companies to give you an insight on what we're doing within this space in order to address the consumer demands. You know, Lisa talked from a traditional media perspective and how they're moving into making more technology available, content. Then we worked with Uberflip and how they have the technology to allow consumers to continue to engage with the content, so selling it to magazines, book publishers, and other types of content individuals. And then to Mike with Maven, say, you know, the whole environment of who recommends your content is so important today in a social media context. So I felt it was really important to hear from someone who's developed an app on the concept of recommendations. So I thank the panelists today for giving us insight across the entire spectrum of the digital opportunity and challenges that we face as media companies. So thank you for your participation.